Hi, I'm Chad Hughes, and you're listening to Elevated Access, the Inside Story. This episode, I met with Chris Baker, CEO of Avanti Energy. Chris breaks down the lessons and experiences that have shaped his approach to business today, including his time in Eastern Europe, where things were 180 degrees different than they are in Canada. Chris shares how he has learned to prioritize understanding culture, communities, and history in preparing for engagement. And he shares a valuable philosophy that has enabled him to be welcomed back into boardrooms and kitchen tables across the globe. Let's tune in to the conversation with Chris. All right. Our guest today is Chris Baker. Chris has over 20 years of access experience working within the oil and gas and the mining sector. His journey began while working as a consulting economist for the government of BC. And it was during this time that he was first made aware of the land access profession. Chris has worked in a number of different land access roles, primarily in Western Canada and also in Europe, where he supported the land acquisition for a gold mine. Today, Chris devotes his time as CEO of Avanti Energy, a Canadian-based helium exploration company. Chris holds a bachelor's and a master's in economics from Queen's and the University of Victoria, and an MBA from the University of Calgary. He also comes from rural roots, having been raised on a farm in southern Ontario. Chris, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, me as well. We kind of connected when we did our prep call for this, and I learned some things about you, like your rural roots, that I thought was pretty cool, and among others. And I'm excited too to lean into the story today and share that, have you share that with our guests. So let's start with your background. Tell us about your background and what led you into the world of access.
Well, as you said, I guess we could start right at the beginning since you've touched on it. I'm a farm boy from Ontario, and you know, that's about an hour and a half southwest of Toronto, where I grew up. And coming out of that, you know, I really want to be a farm guy and go into that world, but my dad talked me out of it and talked me into staying in school for a while. And so I went to Queen's and did a bachelor's in economics there. And it was a great experience, you know, to just see the world in a different way, as you know, many people go off to the city like that and be exposed to new ideas and so many ideas and people from across the country. And from there, I moved out to Victoria, did a master's there. Took a summer job with the BC government, and that evolved into a full-time consulting job for about a year and a half, and quite enjoyed that as well. That was with the BC Ministry of Agriculture, and I was the only farm guy that applied for the job, so that's why I got it. And, you know, after about a year and a half of living there, though, I wasn't really meshing with Victoria. I thought there was better opportunities elsewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, nice lifestyle, but in terms of the career path that I was hoping to follow, Victoria was kind of limited for me at that time. And so I ended up moving to the interior of BC and did some work for the BC government there, bounced around a lot of the interior parts of the province, and ended up in Northeast BC up in Dawson Creek. And really love that area. It's a beautiful area. Just amazing country. And I kind of stayed up there thinking I was going to farm, and but you know, we just need that nest egg, right, to get started. And so I was still consulting, and then the consulting work ran out, and I was talking to a fellow one day, and he says, well, with your background, he says, you really should just be a landman. And I had no idea what that meant, but, made a few phone calls. And I think on my third call, I got a job, and that kind of started the journey in the access world for me.
Yeah. Awesome. I can relate to the farming piece, coming similar, as we talked about, you know, similar backgrounds. And there was a time where I thought that my land, my career in land would enable me to farm. And then as I, in my case, as I got more entrenched into the land and the access business, I thought to myself, I don't want to go back farming now. I mean, I don't want to do that. So once you got introduced to the land business, the access business, how did your career evolve from there?
Well, I spent the first winter with a consulting company and good bunch of folks. But the way the setup was didn't quite work out for me. And so I left there and was going to go back consulting. And then a second service company called me and I decided to work for them for the summer was my initial thought. And by the end of the summer, they had made me manager of that office. That was one of the bigger land companies at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was manager of their Fort St. John office and kind of got thrown in the deep end. I had about 10 months experience at that point. And, but, you know, it was great in many ways. Like the environment that British Columbia was at the time was, you know, now it's really a center of oil and gas. At the time, it was kind of a peripheral idea mm-hmm. for oil and gas. And the companies that worked there were, you know, 10 to 30 wells, maybe the odd company drilled 50 wells a year. And these are the old verticals and, you know, so fairly quick operations. It was never enough that the companies had their own in-house expertise. And so we had 3 dozen clients and we'd have a lot of people call up and say, I don't want to know anything about how to do it. Just let me know when I can drill and, keep us out of trouble. Mm-hmm. And, that was a tremendous learning opportunity for me, of course. And, you know, had I started my career somewhere else, you know, I wouldn't have been exposed to near as many things as I was up there. Mm-hmm. So I used to joke that stint of my career was like dog years. Like one there was worth 7 down in maybe the Calgary head office or something like that.
So. Yeah, absolutely. There definitely is a difference in what you do in a year. Like you can have 20 years of experience, but it's like 1 year of the same thing over and over again, or you can have 1 year of some real dynamic stuff. Absolutely. Nowadays, the BC experience and having that kind of background, I mean, that is a very sought after skill set. And so who knew at the time that would be the case today? Yeah. How did the rural roots help you in that? Did you find that the Southern Ontario farming background was an enabler?
Certainly more than a city background. You know, there's always some skepticism, I guess, when they find out you're an Ontario boy, you know, living out west and that sort of thing. But it didn't take long before the credibility was built up, and you know, we could talk tractors and cattle and all those good things.
Yeah.
And you know, that connection helped a lot for sure. You know, and I think the common experiences helped a lot as well. You know, the normal day-to-day stresses of farm life and, and trying to raise a family and keep your family farm going. And and at that time, you know, there were some pretty trying years. There was some, basically 2 summers in a row, there was just torrential rains. And, I think there was, well, I don't know what the percentage was, but there's a significant number of farmers that, didn't get a crop 2 years in a row, which caused a tremendous amount of stress, as you can imagine. You know, and having some understanding of that, I think helped, you know, brought some credibility to my discussion.
Yeah, I think it's such a relational role. And so when you're able to relate and really relate, it certainly helps in building that rapport and the trust with the people you're dealing with. So it's a good underlying background to have in this line of work for sure. So as your career went on, maybe take us on that journey a little bit. And as you do, point out when you started to develop some of your own philosophies around access, dealing with, you know, landowners or stakeholders or communities, or even maybe philosophies around dealing with your own company. You know, as oftentimes we're negotiating just as much internally as we are externally. So maybe take us a little further down the journey, but speak to some of those philosophies that you developed.
Sure, sure. You know, one of the, as we mentioned in the pre-interview, you know, I've been 20 plus years in oil and gas, and this is the first time I haven't worked Northeast BC. I've had multiple jobs, multiple roles, and almost all of them have eventually circled back to working that area. And, you know, that what's really worked well is as a philosophy is just treat everybody like you're going to see them again, because you probably mm-hmm. are. And, you know, that's kind of a simple line, but it wraps up a lot of things like transparency and consistency and you know, just honest dealings with folks, you know, and there are times in the patch, maybe not as much as there used to be, but there are times when you get a lot of pressure on you to just, you know, to heck with tomorrow, let's just do it today, say whatever you have to say, do whatever you have to do. You know, pushing back on that was, you know, sometimes it was a little bit risky in terms of as mm-hmm. a consultant, you know, that was the right thing to do. And I think it stood well for me over time. You know, I can still show my face up there after, you know, 20 something years and hundreds of wells and pipelines and facilities constructed up there. I think I still have friends up there and people, I don't think people speak too badly of me at all after all the work we've done. So, but in terms of the journey, the career path from there, the next step after the service company was to move in house, as many people do, and work for an oil and gas company. So I moved to Grand Prairie and worked for Canadian Hunter, which was a great experience. I really loved those people. And, you know, the company culture there was amazing. Just everybody just loved being there every day. And that was, you know, something that's always stuck with me as well. And so in my current role, I'm, you know, I often think back to those days and the culture that was built and hope to replicate that. So after, it was about a year and a half, 2 years, that company was taken over. And nothing wrong with the new company, but the culture was different. You know, I looked at it as an opportunity to maybe look further afield for adventure and for work. And that's when I took an opportunity to go to Eastern Europe, and I worked in Romania for a year, working on the land acquisition for a gold mine. So we were doing the land acquisition, and then there was also a whole resettlement aspect as well. So there was basically a village or a couple of small villages with farms and residential houses, and need to work through all the process of acquiring that land. And then there was another group that we worked with that were building brand new villages for the people to move to if they chose to, or they could have cash and move on. But really, really interesting experience. It was every bit as eye-opening and shocking as I hoped it would be when I went there. Yeah. So after a year of that, I would have stayed longer, but my daughter was on the way, and I thought that it was better to raise her in Canada than Eastern Europe. So moved back to Canada and did a half a year with the previously mentioned company. And then I moved to Calgary and started with Encana and took over a land group that, again, looked after a portion of Northeast BC. And they had just done their large cut bank purchase, which I think at the time was the largest land purchase in Canadian history. It was 300 and something thousand acres. And it was a very splashy land sale that went on, and then they had to deliver. And that was a whole, you know, the whole approach to that was very new. You know, as I mentioned before, like up until that point, you know, 30 to 50 wells was a pretty large company for BC operations. And, you know, we were going into that 100 plus range a year and moving from, you know, kind of an 80-20 split between winter and summer drilling to doing a 12-month load leveled drilling program. And that was really a first in much of Canada to do that. So that was it was quite a challenge for us to get that.
I want to lean in on a couple spots here and just be, I want to come back to the cut bank acquisition, mm-hmm. but going back to your year in Eastern Europe. So how was it different from what you were used to dealing with from a land access perspective? Help us understand or comprehend just the differences between how we do it here and how they do it there.
Like 180 degrees different. Couldn't really describe it. you know, they, when I was there, so that was 2002, 2003. So we were, you know, just a little more than a decade after communism, after the wall fell and coming out of all that, right? So you have to put it into some context that way, that, you know, that communist regime that the people lived under for 70 odd years was pretty brutal. And they had, the dictator there had some pretty interesting ideas about how economy should evolve and how country should evolve. And he had read about, you know, the Industrial Revolution in England and Germany and the depopulation of the rural areas and how everybody moved to the cities, you know, in the Industrial Revolution. And he felt that's what was needed for his country to advance. It was a pretty rural, agrarian country. And he forcibly went in and depopulated the countryside, you know, over the years, and just, you know, people would just have a knock at their door and the army would be there. And it's like, you don't own this farm anymore. You're moving to this apartment in town. Wow. See you later. Right. You know, not much compensation, no job prospects, nothing like that. And he just thought this thing was going to happen. And so you can imagine the emotional scars that people have and the resentment they have to any sort of power larger than them mm-hmm. coming to acquire their land. You know, so the resistance was understandable, but tremendous. And, you know, some people understood what we were trying to do, but there was a lot of folks who were very, very wary of you know, someone coming in and trying to buy their farm and move them into a different area. We never chose the expropriation route. We did everything voluntarily. And that was a key aspect, right? Is that this wasn't a show of force. They may have, you know, they felt a power discrepancy perhaps because we were a fairly large company, but, you know, that was kind of one of our recognitions of that history that they had to go through. But again, you know, consistency was the biggest thing. You know, we treated everybody with, as much consistency as possible. We had formulas for how we valued, like, literally everything that they had. You know, so it was a square footage of their house, the state of their house, how many apple trees they had. They got paid for that. How much, you know, how many hectares of land they had. There was a whole formula. And the more consistent we could be with that, the mm-hmm. more credibility we built up. Because one thing that's consistent there is here is no one likes to be the dumbest guy in the coffee shop, as I like to say, and find out that they got a worse deal than their neighbor. And, so that consistency really helped a lot in there, but it was a really, really interesting time. You know, I think as a country, they've come a long ways and become more westernized in many ways. But, you know, being there at that particular time was something that, you know, one might not experience again in terms of the transition from, communism to the market world and all the. There was a lot of dislocation that came with it, not because of us, but just in general in the country. There's a lot of people who may not have liked the system they were under, but they were used to it. And that amount of change from top to bottom across the country was a tremendous.
You touched on something there that I think is really important for those that are in this line of work to keep in mind, and that is understanding the culture in the communities that you're working in and understanding that background. Like you know, as you were describing the history and the sensitivities that people had because of that communism and how they were treated, and then how that led you to take an approach where you did not use expropriation. And I think, you know, that's a really important thing I want to highlight is just understanding your audience and the cultural aspect of the community you're working in. And I think, you know, we might have touched on this when we first met about the Indigenous community in Canada and how there's, you know, probably some similarities there when you're consulting with those communities and understanding the history and the culture itself. But the so the gold mine that you were working on in Romania, were you successful? Were they successful? Did they, at least from an access perspective, did they get what they needed?
We got a long ways down the road, but they ran into a lot of political opposition. It became one of those cause celebs on the global stage where a lot of people who didn't really have a stake in the game in any way would start putting their opinions in global press. And so we made pretty good strides, but the whole thing just became a political mess at the national and international level. And so I can't, I don't believe they ever got it across the goal line, to be honest. I haven't kept up with it. It's been quite a few years now, but I can just look back on the work that I and my team did there and be proud of that. And, the other things that were going on were, well above my pay grade, as they say. And, couldn't have any control over it, but it was a learning experience on that as well, that there was a very coordinated global campaign, media campaign against the project. And,
For sure. It was, in Canada today, like they exist, right? We have this, and I think that's, the thing with access, and I think it's often maybe understated a little bit, the importance of it, but what's also understated is the variables. And, we're dealing with those that are directly affected, but then there's all these other variables like policy, and public, sentiment, I guess, and they all come into play too, and they all impact the access piece. Let's come back to so you came back working within Kenna, end up back in Northeast BC, but I want to hear more about the Cut Bank project, because from what I understand, that at the time was quite an undertaking, and I wonder if you could help us understand what made it complex, what were some of those variables that you had to lean into to move that forward.
Yeah, in terms of access, I mean, it was a lot of things were new, and we were really pushing the envelope of what people even considered it was possible at the time. The scale of the drilling that we were doing up there, in the north, I can't remember the exact numbers. It was well north of 100 wells a year, and that coupled with what I mentioned before, that we moved to 12 month a year access. It was a completely new idea, right? The Northeast BC was very much, winter focused area. And then the road bans come on with spring breakup, and it was, just dead silence, right? There's tumbleweeds blowing around. There's no work at all for about 2 months. And then slowly the work starts to pick up again. And, being able to overcome that, on a number of fronts was tremendous amount of work for a lot of people, a lot of conversations, and a lot of planning involved. So, we had to work with the government to change the road regulations to allow us to bond the roads. That wasn't even a practice that happened at that time. Working with the communities to assure them that we weren't going to destroy the roads, and any damage that happened, we'd take care of it. Yeah, a lot of things like that were very unique. And one of the things that also came about was a lot of permanent road construction as well, like oil field roads, whereas you might have gone in, on frozen winter roads in the past, you'd have to create a 12-month access road. And, that created a lot of work and a lot of jobs for folks, but it was also very new. And going into areas that were prior to that, fairly limited in terms of their year-round access. It created a lot of discussions, from both pros and cons, right? The people who had grazing leases, they loved it. Mm. They could get out and move their cattle around and have all these roads to access. Some of the guides and hunters, they weren't quite as enthused about it because they liked their area a little more untouched. Understandably. And, so it was an interesting time for sure. Now it's quite common, but we were really the trendsetters on that. And, local government was, and the provincial government were both, I think, supportive, but a little cautious. And so we had to, you know, really, what mattered, you know, was walking the talk, as we used to say. You know, we could make these promises, and we got these temporary allowances to do it. And we simply had to perform. And building that culture of caring all the way through the company was important as well. You know, like I wouldn't be there for every rig move or water truck that went down the road, but you had to, you had to build that culture of caring all the way through and having those folks understand all the concerns and understand what was at risk. You know, so we implemented a number of programs in the company that I think that were pretty successful in driving that message home to people. And, you know, and we weren't without stumbles, but, overall I think it went really well. And, you know, wherever there was, you know, a stumble or something didn't work quite the way you'd hoped, how you responded is what really mattered. Right. And built that credibility. I don't think anybody expected us to be perfect, but they do expect you to live to your word. And, you know, so we, you know, when things like that would happen, you know, I think we stepped up to the plate and did the right things and, and, you know, built our reputation from there. So it was, you know, when we started it, both internally and externally, a lot of people said we couldn't do it. And, and you know, both on a regulatory front, the people that, outside of the regulators say the regulators wouldn't support it. And then the regulator said the community wouldn't support it. The community says, well, your company's not going to act properly. And the company said, you're not going to get any of this done.
Yeah.
And, you know, but eventually we put it all together but it was a, you know, a huge communication effort was the main thing. First, good planning, and then communication, and then consistency is really,
you mentioned kind of a bunch of things
success, so.
in that description of that, that project, that undertaking. And one of the things that stands out is you have all these different interested parties. You mentioned the grazing leaseholders. You mentioned the hunters, trappers. Then there's the regulator. Then there's the county or the municipality. And then there's the company. And like, and what's interesting I find about the relational aspect of the work we do is that they're really, it's hard to, well, we can't necessarily go into these situations being right, because everybody is right in their own mind. The hunter, he's right, and he has he's entitled to his concerns and opinions, as is the grazing leaseholder, and so on and so forth. How, you know, when you consider all of these different interests and some are for, some are against, some are on the fence, whatever it may be. How do you manage that? And I think you kind of touched on this as well, but I just want to go a little deeper with balancing the different interests.
Yeah. Balance is the right word. You know, in many cases you can't accommodate 100% of what they want, but you can do your best. And, you know, if a person wants land to be pristine and untouched, pristine in their mind, and untouched for development, you know, any amount of development is going to set them off and leave them disappointed. But there's a way to do the development that would minimize their concerns and the impacts that they see. And, you know, that's really where the balance comes in. You know, you wouldn't want to railroad them and do just what's good for you, but there's a way to develop it. You know, maybe you worry about lines of sight and long roads and, you know, locating well sites and that sort of thing in an area that, you know, has less visual impact, would be that sort of thing is something that if you can accommodate, you should, and work with people to try to achieve that balance. Like you said, you know, when people get positional, you know, it's hard to meet them unless you do exactly what they say. But if you can go back to that positions versus interest idea and find out what their interests are, and like, it's, And there, and you know, in the case of a hunter or a guide outfitter, his interest might be, well, I want my guests to have a good experience, right? I don't want them to have this noise issue, or I don't want to have this visual impact or something like that. If you know that's the issue behind it, then you can find ways to work, you know, and address their real concerns that are underneath their positions. You know, that was an old course I took way back. I think it was the RWA course, but it was excellent, right? Just to, you know, pull those things apart and really focus on those interests.
Makes sense.
And the drivers.
You touched on culture, like, and I love that you did that, and you've touched on it a couple of times. And I, you know, with your experience with Canadian Hunter, and you mentioned the culture there, and then, you know, as you moved on from there, you noticed the difference in culture. And then again, you mentioned it with this cutbank undertaking and the culture of caring and how that really helped. I wonder if you could help us or help our listeners understand like the variances in the culture and how you have seen that impact the access piece.
A lot of things come down to incentives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm thinking in terms of companies, for example, you know, the staff in companies. And, you know, one of the ways to align culture properly is to have the right incentives in place. And if, you know, I'll pick on, I don't know, a trucking guy or something. If the guy in charge of trucking is only incented to do things as fast as possible and as cheap as possible with no concerns for anything else, they're going to act in a certain way. But if they are incented to align with the bigger picture of the company's goals, mm-hmm. they're going to act in a way that would align with the company's goals, of course, right? You know, so they'll manage their dust, they'll manage their noise. But, you know, to get to that point, to create those incentives, you need that vision outlined pretty clearly across the company, you know, and people at the highest levels need to recognize the value that it brings, you know, especially when you're, you know, the world we're in now, these resource plays where you're in a community for 20, 30 years, maybe more, and you just can't burn your bridges and act that way. You need to act like they're your partners and neighbors for that full time. You know, if you can get that understanding across the various disciplines in an oil and gas company, I think you can have, you know, pretty good success in mm-hmm. in you know, partnering with the communities. But it needs to be there. It has to be more than talk. There has to be incentives for that sort of thing. And then people will act accordingly.
Well, you know, through your career, when you think of the culture and the differences in culture, was it a top down thing? Like, did you notice that, you know, those leaders at the top of the organization were leading in a different way than, you know, in one circumstance than another? Was there a connection there between their behavior and the culture?
Early on, you know, they were pretty open to discussions about how they could achieve their goals, right? And, you know, if the goal was we're going to be here for several decades working this property, you know, how do we do that? And they had open discussions, and, you know, they wouldn't have had the details, I guess, in their minds of what the concerns would have been from the community, but they were very open to hear them. And once they understood them, they were very supportive, and that's, you know, that trickled all the way down through the company, you know, both through incentives and actions and, you know, policies. It did take an awful lot of support from the top. You know, if they were only concerned about you know, time and money mm-hmm. in the short term, it's really time and money. It really pays off in the long term. But if you're only worried about this quarter's results and mm-hmm. And forget about tomorrow, it's easy to ignore those things. But you're really building yourself a problem, and you're gonna have a hard time delivering for the long term. And you know, to their credit, our leadership then you know, took a very long term view of the properties. And the development that we had there. And so they bought in fully.
I think it's a great segue into what you're doing today. And I wonder if we could start with maybe telling us a little bit about your company today, Avanti, and then I want to lean into a few things around that, like your role, et cetera. But first, tell us about your company. What are you up to?
Yeah, we're Avanti Energy is a pure play helium explorer, and we're acquiring lands in southern Alberta and northern Montana. At the moment, the helium market has got a tremendous supply demand imbalance, and that's been kind of building here for the last few years. And prior to this, helium was seen as a byproduct of certain gas fields, primarily in the U.S. And those gas fields are in decline, and the demand is growing, particularly from high-tech uses for helium. And of course, that led to price signals that's attracted junior explorers. And so we're in the process of building a really nice portfolio of land, and should be having drills on the ground here in the next few months, probably late Q3, early Q4 of this year. So my role there is I'm CEO. And it's been a great learning experience as well. We started out as a private company, and when we started, approaching the market and looking for funding opportunities to build our private company into, the going concern that we are today, we came across Avanti, which was a publicly traded but basically a shell company at this point. They used to be a natural gas company, but sold their assets off over the years. The fellows there were looking for an opportunity to use that vehicle, for another either oil and gas or similar opportunity. And we were looking for funding, and it was actually a really good match. The partnership that we have with the folks that own that previously and they're still involved in the company has been really, really strong. They bring a lot of public market knowledge, and the team that we've built, the foundation of which are ex-Encana people, that we've kind of pivoted into helium. They're showing, we've got tremendous success so far. I'm really proud of where we're at. And so the combination between a strong financial side and a strong operations and exploration side is
no kidding.
Really,
well,
proven out to be a real win for
I'm everyone. Curious, what's driving that market, the helium market? What's the demand side?
Yeah, it really goes into a lot of high tech.
Okay.
So the biggest slice of the pie is MRI machines. Most people don't realize that. So the magnets in MRI machines, they require ultra cold temperatures to operate correctly, and helium liquefies at something like minus 268 Celsius. So it's extremely cold. And that's the biggest slice. And then things like welding and industrial uses are next. But the real growth areas are things like high tech manufacturing. So fiber optic cables are manufactured in a helium environment because you don't want the atmosphere involved there. Semiconductor construction or manufacturing uses helium in a couple different spaces. Server farms like Netflix and Amazon and Google and their big server farms, they're switching to these helium-filled hard drives because they get 50% more capacity and they use 23% less energy. What else? NASA and SpaceX are big buyers. They need it for their rockets. So they do leak testing and purging of their rockets, that sort of thing. So that's really, it's really interesting. The growth areas are primarily, it's overall population demand, but within that, the real growth of our world is really high tech and healthcare. And, both of those have strong connections to helium. And so every time you pick up your cell phone or your laptop, there's a helium connection. You drive your car, it's full of semiconductors now. There's a connection to helium. And just with the overall global picture of it, North America is about 40% of the market and also production. It's currently a bit of an exporter, but globally the supplies are from places like Qatar and Algeria and Russia. And I think for the strength of the North American economy, we need to make sure we have this critical element supplied locally. within the North American region. You know, we've kind of learned our lesson from the rare earth minerals world, where, you know, China has most of that captured. You know, it's either China or you know, unstable places in say Africa or something, you know, unstable governments. And that puts a lot of risk in the macro picture for the economy and for society. You know, and if you can't get that rare mineral that makes your cell phone work, and suddenly people can't get a new iPhone, it sounds like a luxury, but it's really, it's a day-to-day tool now, and it's pretty hard to operate without a phone. And so, you know, we look at helium on a global basis, and you know, we're very pleased to be part of this.
I think we've been awakened to the
building crisis that we're seeing,
the supply chain, and how fragile it can be. And so, what's the like? How do you get? So there's the exploration part for the helium. What's it look like getting it to the market? Where does it from go once it comes out of the ground?
Yeah, the exploration side is very much like natural gas, for anyone who doesn't know. So it's, you know, we drill for it with the very same rigs we drill natural gas for. When it gets to surface, basically the helium is anywhere from 0.3 to 2 or more percent of the total gas flow. The rest could be natural gas, or it could be nitrogen or some other gases like that. But once you've concentrated it down to greater than 99% helium, it's basically trucked. You may have seen these semis on the road where they basically have, like, you know, a number of kind of long cigar tubes on the back. And that would be, in some cases, those would be transporting helium. There's really about a half a dozen big buyers of it, and they buy it on the wholesale market and redistribute it back to the retail. So companies like Praxair or Air Liquide, Messair, you know, those are some of the bigger buyers. And the market is primarily, you know, bilateral contracts rather than, you know, in natural gas or oil. If you can go on the NYMEX and do, you know, find your pricing, you know, every minute you can see a price update. You know, these tend to be one-on-one contracts, and you know, can last for several years. So it's a little opaque that way, but there's certainly enough for price signals out there for people to be encouraged.
So interesting. You know, as I was joking earlier before we started recording about should have been out speculating, picking up helium rates when, you know, before it started to take off. But it's interesting to see the changes in the cycles of commodities that that are desired, and what's economic and what's not. And it's great to see. We're fortunate in Canada. We're so resource rich, like we are. I want to.
And I would say, just add to that too. I mean, talent rich. You know, you know, Western Canada, and you know, I'm a proud Calgarian. You know, we have a concentration of talent here that's unrivaled. You know, and so our ability to take that talent and pivot it into a new industry, but without any skill upgrades or any skill changes required. It's just it's kind of a frontier opportunity for folks. It's pretty amazing, you know. It's not always that people can do.
No,
that.
I agree. We are a get her done society, and I skipped over a little bit of your journey between the focus on access and then your role as CEO, and I want to kind of come back and touch on that a little bit, but. You know, today you're in this role as CEO, and I think that's remarkable. And I'm curious about how your experience and your start and a big part of your journey being focused on land access. But you also did a stint a stint while you were in Canada that was more commercial type work.
Commercial side,
If you can just connect some dots for us on, you know, there's the access piece and you moved into the commercial piece. Maybe talk a little bit about that. And then how that's sort of equipped you to be in the role you're in today as CEO of a new exploration company.
Sure. Yeah. So as one of the changes that went on with the company, we had an early downturn and layoff situation in about 2013. I think we were one of the first companies to go through layoffs. And at that time, I had a pretty substantial surface land and Indigenous relations team. We ended up laying off about 30% of my team at that point. When that process was over, they said, "Okay, Chris, you're next. Do you want a package or do you want to move into this other role?" And I had expressed interest in the commercial world before. And I said, "Well, tell me about that." And they said, "It's same pay, no staff." And I said, "That sounds really, really good." And so, but it was a really great move for me. And so that role was, they called that Group Commercial Services. And we were doing the commercial arrangements for the facilities that were being built up in the Montney. So, there's two parts to it. There was one partnership agreement that we did with a third party company that did the financing and ownership of three big gas plants that totaled 1 billion cubic feet a day of processing. And so it was their money, their ownership, our construction, and our operatorship. And so that was a fairly complex arrangement. And then there was another half a BCF or more of gas processing that was handled by existing plants. So, a little more typical third party negotiations there, some of the bigger gas plants in the region. And, it was great. There's a lot of things in life where, it's easy to say, and then you have to go do it and you find out the nuance, right? And the details. And that's really, really where the skill set is, to say, "Well, just go get a deal with so-and-so and take your gas there." That's an easy thing to say, but it's an awful lot of work goes behind that. And in some cases you end up with a 500 page agreement and then you find out that agreement is really just guidance because you haven't anticipated everything that's come up, and you have to work through all of those issues that come up over time. And and that, to some degree, that's the tie back to the land part of my career. There's a ton of opportunity for conflict in those situations as well, and how you manage those disagreements and the multiple issues that you'll face. That again comes back to long-term success, and I think the land world actually prepared me quite well for going into that. The other half of my skill set, or the other portion of my skill set that helped, was as you'd mentioned at the beginning, I did my MBA, and that allowed me to apply some of those skills in the commercial world as well. So I think I was ahead of you a few years in that program, but we met through that program I think initially. And, it was good. Like there's a lot of things again that, you think, at a very high level, and then you go do the case studies in an MBA and you have to go figure it out and actually, work things out to the decimal place and really learn it. Good experiences all the way through and things you can't pick up any other way except actually rolling up your sleeves and doing it. That experience in the commercial world, certainly played into my current role. I think, again, you really understand what a business is about at a very, very high level, or I did prior to that. But, really going into the nuts and bolts of the finances of an arrangement, is... It taught me a lot, and I'm certainly bringing all those skills forward today.
So coming back to today and your current role, how are you finding the all the years of dealing with multiple types of stakeholders on the access side and another set of stakeholders on the commercial side. How's it all supporting you or enabling you in your current role?
It's interesting, you know, in the, you know, we're acquiring a lot of land in Montana right now. You know, those are commercial arrangements, but in unlike Alberta, much of that land, much of the mineral rights are held by the farmers and ranchers down there. And having that tie over to surface access has been good. You know, one of the things that we put right in our mineral contracts is, you know, I tried to anticipate a half a dozen or dozen things that most landowners would want for surface about how our activities would impact their lives. And I put those right in the mineral agreements. And I don't think any of them have seen that before. And it's been received really, really well by a number of people. You know, so that's, you know, that's a direct tie. You know, the other lessons of treating people, you know, like you're going to see them again and treat the whole experience like we're there for the long term. That's helped a lot as well. We've got an agreement that, well, by the time this podcast is out, it'll be announced. And, you know, the people that hold that land, you know, it's a farm in on an oil and gas company, but they're, you know, they're kind of a small, relatively small on the national scale company, but they've got, you know, lots of services that they also provide. And they're very, very proud of their local community. And, you know, one of the things that our landman has had, you know, fairly detailed discussions with is about local job opportunity and supporting that community and not bringing in people mm-hmm. from out of state to do the work where we can and building long-term careers. And that's something that, you know, I've probably heard from day one up in Dawson Creek and agree with, you know. I'm a small town guy too, and I totally appreciate the impact of even a half a dozen new jobs. Can be really, 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 really important for a community, you know, to keep the young people home, give them opportunity to raise their own families there mm-hmm. and keep those small towns alive. And so I'm pretty sensitive to that sort of thing. It seems to be bearing fruit that we recognize those right from the start with any discussions we have.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to part of your story of the experience in Eastern Europe and understanding the culture and what they've been through and how you use that understanding to create a better outcome. And what I just heard you say is you're doing that again by taking your understanding of what works and doesn't work and what people maybe appreciate around access and actually getting out in front of it and being proactive to what I heard is kind of a form of differentiating yourself with those landowners, mineral rights holders. I think that's a great example of taking that experience, your background, and applying it to what you're doing today.
Yeah. No, I agree. In more than one case, it's been acknowledged that we're operating very differently from our competitors in the area, and it's bearing fruit, you know. And and so we're really proud of the work we're doing right now. And as I said, we'll be on the ground in a bigger way here in the next few months. And, go back to what I said earlier and we can walk.
What's the culture like?
Right. It's great right now. We're small. And the fact that the core of our team all came from in Canada, we've all worked together before. We didn't have to spend a lot of time, you know, explicitly stating what our culture is going to be. We kind of knew what it was going to be right from the start because we'd all worked together and obviously I had a role in who I picked for our team as well. And I wanted to, obviously bring the skill set, but bring people that really fit well together. And, from there, as we're bringing more people people tend to hire, you know, beyond the skill set, we hire people who fit. And, I'm looking forward to see how we grow. I think the culture is really, really good. People love what they're doing. You know, there's a ton of enthusiasm. There's, you know, a lot of really honest conversations, but always with the best intentions. I would never say there's no conflict at all. But you know, when people have something to say, they're comfortable saying it and we'll have an honest conversation about things. But it's led to tremendous success. I can't wait to announce a bunch of things that are coming up here.
And, yeah, I'm excited to hear about it too. Yeah. Oh, that's great. I love that. I think your journey is quite remarkable, Chris. What advice would you give others that are maybe, you know, either whether they're an access professional or a developer or a proponent, just anywhere you want to go with that.
Yeah.
Some advice that you would share?
You know, the first thing I take every opportunity I can to learn. You know, one of the best things that happened early in my career up in Northeast BC was spending an awful lot of windshield time, as we say, you know, bouncing around in a pickup with a construction guy or a driller or a pipeliner and learning about their world. And the more you can understand their drivers, within the company, the more you can plan better for your land access, the better you can communicate to the communities. So I would take every opportunity to spend time with people who are good at what they do and passionate, and you just need to ask a few simple questions and they'll let you know everything that's important, and they'll become quite enthused. You know, the next thing we've talked about a few times, but do what you can to put yourself in someone else's shoes, and try to understand what might be driving the other people. And if sometimes it's as simple as asking them, and sometimes people can't communicate it. So you need to dig a little deeper. But, in the community side of access, often it's not their profession, right? A lot of people you're dealing with, this is an intrusion on their lives in some ways. And, they shouldn't be faulted for not expressing what's really driving their concerns. Right. They may express one thing, but their real driver might be something else. And it's not a conscious thing. It's not a point of dishonesty, but you might need to spend some time and just work through that and have those discussions to find out what the real drivers are. I saw that once. There was a fella years and years ago when I was just starting out, and he was a nice guy, but man, he was just going off on me about the smallest thing. And, God, it took me an hour and a half of talking to him. And I finally found out his wife had been diagnosed with cancer and it had nothing to do with what we were doing, but he just needed to be heard. And so, we addressed his issue, but mostly he just needed to be taken seriously and spend some time with that fella. And, that was a good lesson, right? It's not always what, again, he wasn't being dishonest. He wasn't trying to mislead us. He wasn't trying to create something where, create an issue intentionally that was bigger than it really was. But he had something else driving him. And once we figured that out, then we could talk through all of his problems and everything got a lot better. But if I'd taken it strictly at the surface level, I think that whole incident could have gone sideways in a hurry and could have been a long-term problem for us.
Yeah. Something to be said about listening for what people aren't saying.
Yes. It's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been great, Chris. Where can people find you if they want to reach out and find out more about Avanti or yourself? Just what's a good place to
reach out through avantienergy.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn. I do my best to respond to everybody. We're getting more and more calls these days, but I do my very best to reach out to everybody that takes the time to talk to me. So happy to offer advice to anybody.
We'll make sure we put your contact info in the show notes page as well. Appreciate it. People can find it there too. But well, this has been great, as I expected it would, and appreciate you taking the time.
All right. Thanks very much, Chad. I've enjoyed it.
All right.
Take care.
Bye for now.